The prelude to Charpentier's Te Deum, Anthony Newman with the English Chamber Orchestra and Wynton Marsalis.
You're listening to Vermont Public Radio. We have Only a Game coming up next. Taking a look at the VPR Arts Calendar, the University of Vermont's Lane Series presents the London City Opera in Lehar's classic comic opera, The Merry Widow. The opera combines romance and Viennese waltzes with a live orchestra. That's The Merry Widow, Friday, February 8th at the Flynn Center in Burlington. For details, call 802-86-FLYNN. We have support for our programming on VPR from our contributing listeners and from the Nature Conservancy, helping Vermonters give to the future by preserving ecologically important lands and the species that dwell there. And Shelburne Bay Senior Living Community on Lake Champlain, offering senior security and independence with enhanced personal services. Celebrating 25 years of broadcasting, this is listener-supported Vermont Public Radio. WBTN, 94.3 FM Bennington. WVPA, 88.5 FM St. Johnsbury. WVPR, 89.5 FM Windsor. WVPS, 107.9 FM Burlington. And WRVT, 88.7 FM Rutland. You can listen on the web at vpr.net. The forecast for today, sunny skies, highs in the lower 20s, clear through midnight tonight, then increasing clouds, the lows 0 to 5 above. Cloudy tomorrow with scattered snow showers developing in the morning, the highs 25 to 30, the chance of snow is 40%.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. They say there's going to be a football game in New Orleans tomorrow. We'll preview the event. We'll also celebrate it in haiku poetry, as has been Only a Game's practice for years and years. And then we'll get serious and talk to a guy who wants bridge to become an Olympic sport. Also coming up on Only a Game, a visit to a college you'll love if you think collegiate sports are overemphasized. At Champlain College, the varsity games will give way to intramural tilts and fitness adventures.
I think that if you were to ask probably the majority of our students, what they would say is we want it all. But I think what we're looking for is how can we make the largest number of opportunities available to the largest number of students.
All this and your letters. Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. Pakistani police say emails sent to CNN and Fox News about kidnapped American reporter Daniel Pearl appear to be hoaxes. The messages claimed Pearl was killed and dumped in a Karachi graveyard. A search of 300 cemeteries in Karachi turned up nothing. A U.S. official says that is good news. An unsigned email Wednesday accused Pearl of spying for Israel. The Justice Department has ordered the White House and other federal agencies not to discard any documents relating to conversations the White House had with Enron executives about the company's financial condition. NPR's Barbara Bradley reports.
In a letter to White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez, the Justice Department requested that all documents that relate in any way to Enron's financial condition and or business interests be preserved. That includes all handwritten notes, emails, computer records, and letters. The White House said it would comply with the order. The Justice Department wants all documents dating back to January 1, 1999, the last 2 years of the Clinton administration. Enron was a large contributor to George W. Bush's presidential campaign, but the company also had extensive ties to the previous administration. The Justice Department has opened a nationwide task force involving investigators and prosecutors in several offices to see if Enron officials acted illegally before the company collapsed. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
In the aftermath of the Enron bankruptcy, President Bush is pushing to overhaul rules on 401k plans. The president will use his weekly radio address today to talk about changes he outlined at a meeting of Republican lawmakers. Under the proposal, managers would be subject to the same blackout periods employees have with their 401ks. At Enron, several managers sold out. Workers were barred from doing so and lost millions of dollars when the company was going under. Democrats are skeptical of the plan and say they'll reveal their own plan soon. The King of Jordan supports the president's attempt to single out Iran, Iraq, and North Korea as an axis of evil. Barry Schweit has more.
The Bush administration couldn't have selected a more supportive Arab leader than King Abdullah of Jordan. He praised President Bush's Mideast policy as fair, on the president's attempt to divide the world's nations into good and evil camps, warm praise from the king as well, and a suggestion to fence-sitters to choose sides. It's the kind of support the president needs. He's been hammering at Yasser Arafat to end Palestinian attacks, criticizing him over an arms smuggling effort. Subtly, though, the king used praise of the president to draw attention to the Palestinians, saying they were suffering and that in his heart, the president wants to alleviate that suffering. From an Arab standpoint, that means resuming U.S. efforts to prod Israel into lifting economic and military restraints and, without much delay, turning over territory for a Palestinian state. For NPR News, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
This is NPR. Evidence continues to mount that the recession is running its course, although the timing and strength of the recovery remain uncertain. Steve Beckner of Market News International reports.
The latest economic numbers tend to validate the Federal Reserve's vote not to cut interest rates again. Unemployment unexpectedly dropped 0.2 to 5.6% in January, and while the true jobless rate was clouded by measurement issues, the rate of job loss did slacken considerably last month. The manufacturing sector may be near the end of its long contraction. The Institute for Supply Management's Index of Industrial Activity rose for the third straight month to within a tenth of the break-even 50 level. The organization's Robert Orr said it is encouraging that the rate of decline has slowed to its lowest measurable level and pointed to increased new orders and production. Consumer confidence, as measured by the University of Michigan, also rose last month, and construction spending rose for the third straight month in December. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
The Dalai Lama is out of the hospital. A hospital official in Bombay says the Tibetan spiritual leader was released after being treated for a stomach infection. He was hospitalized for a week. The Nobel Peace Prize winner walked out of the hospital on his own, looking a bit pale, though he told reporters he feels much better. Nigerian officials have increased the death toll from Sunday's munitions dump blast. The Lagos state governor says more than 1,000 bodies have been pulled from canals where residents either drowned or were trampled to death in a stampede. An armory exploded at a barracks in Lagos. The disaster happened about 1 week ago. It is considered the worst disaster to hit Lagos in years. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Overbrook Foundation, working with the Natural Resources Defense Council to safeguard the Earth and the natural systems on which all life depends.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's probably an exaggeration to say that it's impossible to avoid the Super Bowl, but it's not much of an exaggeration. Much more often than not, at least a few of the playoff games leading up to Super Sunday have been better games than the finale. Everybody knows that, but it doesn't matter. In these days of more and more cable channels, the phenomenon of the program watched by almost everybody is an endangered species, but the Super Bowl still qualifies. Though lots of the people at tomorrow's parties pay attention to pro football on only one day each winter, the centerpiece of this Sunday feast will allegedly be a football game. And so we turn now for the final time this season to our football guy, Paul Attner of the Sporting News, who joins us, not surprisingly, from New Orleans. Hello, Paul.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
You're sober. What's going on?
It's daylight, Bill. I still have to put in some semblance of work down here before nightfall.
Well, how are things in New Orleans? Because I understand that the celebrations were supposed to be toned down a little bit this year. Has that been the case?
Yeah, I think it's a more subdued atmosphere. I really do. Now, I think tonight is going to be probably a lot like it should be on Bourbon Street. And I think, earlier in the week, I think there was not the crowds, there was not the festivities. Part of it is because of the heightened security. I've never seen security like this around any sporting event, even the Olympics, other than maybe Montreal when they had the guns pointing at you almost at every block. This is really an amazing change in the Super Bowl and in the way they're handling it from a security standpoint.
Well, be more specific for me, Paul. What do you see and hear that you weren't aware of and didn't see at previous Super Bowls?
Basically, the previous Super Bowls, there was hardly any noticeable security. I mean, right now, if I walk from this room down the lobby of the Hyatt Regency, which is the media headquarters hotel, there'd be policemen everywhere in the lobby, and every floor you went to, there's a policeman as you get off the elevator. That's never been the case. All week we went through metal detectors wherever we went to get to the media headquarters, to get to the team hotels. They've got streets blocked off all around the Superdome. You can't get into the Hyatt Regency without a badge and a room key, and there's just less people here.
Paul, with only a week between the conference championship games and the Super Bowl, how have all you guys had time to write the critical features about, you know, the woodcraft hobby of the second-string linebacker's mother, that sort of thing?
It has been a challenge, Bill, I tell you. it's probably some of those that haven't been written. I think it's probably, one of the down parts of the Super Bowl that we've missed some of the great angles. But, I think the fact is only been this week from one game to the next. The fact that, the atmosphere is different. The fact that the Patriots seem to be such an astonishing team and not expected to be here. All those things are kind of combined. I've covered 20-plus Super Bowls, and this one is the by far the most unique one I've been to, and we haven't even played the game yet.
There are some intriguing stories, of course, despite the ones that we probably will miss. And as you say, most of them do seem to center around the Patriots. The first one, of course, was how often does a team have a quarterback controversy only days before the Super Bowl? Tom Brady the right choice in that regard?
Yes, I think as long as he proved that he was healthy, which he has a week in practice, that you've got to go with the guy that brung you. I mean, the guy has played quarterback all season, when they started to win. And there's absolutely no reason at this point why you would make a change based on a half of one game by Drew Bledsoe. So, yeah, I think that Belichick made exactly the right choice.
Of course, the other guys are coming into this game with virtually co-most valuable players. Maybe it doesn't matter who is starting for New England.
Well, everybody would think so, and everything on paper, I love that cliche, everything's on paper. Everything on paper says the Rams should win. I've watched all year. I think the Rams should win. But you watch the Patriots, as I have for the past 2 weeks and then another game in December, and you watch them and they win, and you don't know how they do it, and every game they seem to do it in a different way, and despite the opposition, which has different strengths, they seem to find a way to negate those strengths, and they come away with a victory, and you leave and say, they weren't better than the Steelers, but, they won the game convincingly. How do they do that? And I think that's why I have this feeling that they may not pull an upset, but I think it's going to be a lot closer than we should anticipate, and I think they have a decent chance, really, of winning it.
Paul, there are those in New England who are counting on karma rather than matchups at particular positions. Drew Bledsoe was injured months ago, but he came back and performed splendidly at a critical point last week. The Pats shed themselves of problem child Terry Glenn, even though he was regarded as their most talented receiver when the season began. For the past couple of weeks, every deflected pass, every botched kick, every questioned official's call has gone their way. Does any of this stuff matter?
Yeah, you'd like to think it doesn't, but I'll tell you, I've become a believer. I wrote this week that the football gods are sending us a signal that this is the team that they've anointed as the one that should win it, despite the talent deficits that they have. And they win, and they win a little bit like you say, and a lot on really great coaching and great execution. And I think there is something to a team taking these things that go their way, building on them, getting confidence of them, and all of a sudden they're saying, we can win these games. Even if nobody else thinks we can do it. And I think the Patriots have shown that that's true.
Paul, given that a lot of people watch only the Super Bowl and not any other football game during the course of the season, is there a telltale for this game, some event or pattern that comes up early that might let people know whose day it is?
Yeah, I think that if you see early on the Rams clicking on offense, moving down the field, it doesn't seem like the Patriots have a clue how to stop it. I think that's going to be a sign that it's not going to be the New England's day, that it's going to be the Rams' day. I think if the Patriots come out early in the first quarter and can get the Rams off the field fairly routinely, then I think we're looking at having a pretty good ball game.
All right, now you have said that you wouldn't be surprised if New England made a game of it, despite the fact that most people regard the Rams as a fairly overwhelming favorite. But let's have your prediction with numbers included.
Well, I've got to continue to anger all Patriot fans by picking the Rams, but I picked them starting in July. I thought they were the best team in football, and there's no reason why I should change my mind now because they still are. So I think we're talking a 31-17 game with the Rams, and if they turn the ball over four times or more, there's a good chance New England could win it, but I think right now it's 31-17.
Paul Attner covers the NFL for the Sporting News, and he is our pro football analyst. Paul, enjoy Sunday, and we'll see you next year.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it.
Once there was a silly old row. Hutchie could punch and holding me down. No one could make that round scrum. He kept putting that down, but he had it.
On the eve of the Olympics in Salt Lake City, the advocacy organization Utah Issues is reporting that inflated motel prices are driving low-income citizens from the rooms where they've been living. At the Zions Motel, the weekly rate for a room has gone from $180 to $735. The motel's owner said this week, "I don't feel any guilt in our supply and demand economy. That's what America is all about." At the Salvation Army and some of the other places serving the needs of homeless citizens in Salt Lake, there are notices of temporary job opportunities having to do with the Olympics. Some of the jobs provide workers with Olympic jackets, but most of them do not pay enough for those taking the jobs to afford the rents in the city. Advocates for low-income Americans have planned a demonstration called March for Our Lives for February 8th, the day of the opening ceremonies. From Salt Lake City, Beverly Amsler has this report on the conditions low-income citizens are facing in these pre-Olympic days.
On a street in downtown Salt Lake City, Ken stands on the sidewalk outside a shopping mall. Every day, all day, he holds his cardboard sign.
It says, "Homeless, please help, God bless."
Ken has lived on the streets of Salt Lake City for 18 months and says begging is his only source of income. He isn't looking forward to the Winter Olympics.
I heard that for the 11 days during the Olympics, you're going to have a permit to come uptown. I don't know what they mean by that, but that'll probably mean me. They probably won't want people like us up here.
A recent poll by two national homeless advocacy groups listed Salt Lake City among the meanest places in the country in terms of ordinances against the homeless. But Mayor Rocky Anderson defends his city. He says his is the most caring community in America. And the city has learned from the mistakes Atlanta made with its homeless during the 1996 Summer Olympics.
We're not doing police roundups of people who have outstanding warrants. We're not making it illegal for people to cross a parking lot if they haven't parked there. We haven't given the homeless one-way tickets out of town.
But at least one homeless advocate disagrees. Glenn Bailey heads the Crossroads Urban Center, where many of the homeless come to get help. Bailey says police have stepped up the number of trespass citations they've issued, even to people standing on the center's front porch.
People being told by police officers verbally, you've been here long enough, you need to get out of town. People being having suggestions made of programs that they might get into with the condition that when they're done, they get a bus ticket out of state. None of these things are consistent with the mayor's policy. None of these things are consistent with SLOC's policy.
Police officers in Salt Lake City have no written policy on how to treat the homeless during the games. Sydney had a written code of conduct for its police officers during the 2000 Summer Olympics, and a homeless organization run by the Sydney government conducted a study of how its homeless were treated 2 weeks before as well as during the games. Although neither of those measures are planned here, Salt Lake City Police spokesman Fred Lewis says courtesy is their motto.
We're going to treat the homeless with every bit of dignity and respect. just like we treat any other person. Our officers are encouraged. If they see someone on the street who may be in need, our officers are encouraged to try to help them.
Despite the fears of people like Ken, Lewis says the homeless won't need a permit to come downtown.
If that person's on the street and they're obeying the law, they're not violating any ordinances, that person's has every right to be there. My officers won't be, as you say, sweeping them off the street. They have every right to be there.
Charitable organizations are preparing to care for the homeless. About 100 AmeriCorps volunteers from across the country are here helping the homeless find shelter. Some local churches are giving those in need a place to stay during the games if the shelters are full. Some organizations have doubled the amount of food they've prepared to give out. And the Salt Lake Organizing Committee has agreed to donate thousands of pounds of leftover food to the shelters and food banks. For Only a Game, I'm Beverly Amsler in Salt Lake City.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. He scored 1,283 goals. He led Brazil to 3 World Cup championships. He is Pelé, and at 61, he will be, according to Pfizer Inc., the largest drug manufacturer in the world, a dandy spokesperson for Viagra. Pelé has represented numerous products since his soccer career ended 25 years ago. On Monday, both Pfizer and Pelé confirmed that negotiations were taking place. There is speculation that the deal will be announced in mid-February, shortly after Brazil's famous and infamous annual carnival, when nearly everyone in the country will be hungover and worn out.
Only a Game on Vermont Public Radio is funded by you, our listeners, and by Trapp Family Lodge in Stowe, where professionally orchestrated business meetings are conducted in the new Mozart, Schubert, and Strauss rooms. From the VPR Arts Calendar, storyteller and songwriter Bill Harley appears at the Flynn Center Sunday, February 10th. Harley's a regular commentator for NPR's All Things Considered. He brings a unique style of storytelling, focusing on the details of everyday life, offering a mix of fantasy and reality. Harley will be joined by blues pianist Keith Munslow. That's Sunday, February 10th at Burlington's Flynn Center. If you'd like details, call 802-86-FLYNN. Sunny the forecast for today. The highs in the lower 20s. Clear through midnight tonight, but then clouding up. The lows 0 to 5 above tonight. Cloudy tomorrow with some scattered snow showers developing in the early morning. The highs 25 to 30, chance of snow 40%. And continuing clouds with snow showers Sunday night, lows in the mid to upper teens.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a Vermont college prepares to explore a better life without varsity sports. But first, of all the forms of team competition the world has to offer, bridge might appear to be among the more unlikely candidates for inclusion in the Olympics. That hasn't stopped proponents of the game from saying that bridge would be a worthy addition to the ever-growing collection of Olympic events. In order to encourage the International Olympic Committee to consider that possibility, the World Bridge Federation is staging a pre-Olympic tournament in Salt Lake City, the idea being that once the Lords of the Rings have seen bridge in action, they'll take up the cause. Joining me now on the line is Mike Becker, the president of the United States Bridge Federation. Mr. Becker, welcome to Only a Game.
A pleasure to be here on your sports program.
Have you any indication that any of the members of the IOC will, in fact, drop by to witness the bridge championship in Salt Lake City?
Well, one of the reasons we're there is we're hoping that some Olympic officials will drop by, and we think they will.
Why the Winter Olympics rather than the Summer Olympics? Was that a toss-up or a particular choice?
The Summer Olympics is rather crowded with other sports. It's very hard to add additional sports there. We thought we'd have a better chance of being in the Winter Olympics. But right now, the Winter Olympics require that any sports there be on either snow or ice. So we'd have to get ice skates or skis or something on in order to perform unless they change their rules.
And it would be very weird to be sitting still with skates or skis on.
Well, I was thinking more of like a biathlon where you'd play some hands at one bridge table and then speed skate to the next table.
Now we're getting somewhere. This is beginning to make some sense to me.
But they'd actually just have to change their rules and allow sports such as bridge in there. That's the route we're taking.
What sort of resistance has this effort encountered?
Well, we've been mocked and made fun of. Some people think it would look funny for a bunch of people between the ages of, let's say, 35 and 70 marching with a flag into the Olympic Stadium.
That would be the least of the problems, I would think, because it does bring up the question of if bridge becomes an Olympic sport, are we to consider bridge players athletes?
We have a lot of the same ingredients in our sport as other sports. And if I were to mention to you what sport am I talking about here, hockey or basketball or speed skating, if I mention coolness under pressure, you might think of those sports, but mm-hmm. I'm talking about bridge, focus and concentration, stamina and fitness, preparation and practice, the ability to get over your mistakes. These are all things associated with sports, and the identical things are associated with bridge because they're all competitions.
Yeah, I see what you mean. But you mentioned that there has been a fair amount of ridicule, and I have in front of me an article from the London paper called The Independent, in which the columnist suggests that if the cards were made of dense steel, perhaps bridge could make it as an Olympic sport, because then it would be hard to lift them and hold them in your hand.
Well, that's if you have the idea that everything in the Olympics has to have to do with using your muscles.
Right.
Obviously, the brain is not a muscle, but everybody uses their brains in the Olympics.
I don't argue at all that bridge is a worthy sport, and millions of people play it worldwide. No doubt about that. It's hugely successful and enjoyed by huge amounts of people. What would the benefit be to the sport if it were to become an Olympic sport?
I think if bridge became an Olympic sport, the number of young people who currently might be playing video games or watching television, they would turn towards playing bridge. It would receive more prestige than it has now, and bridge keeps the brain healthy.
Mike Becker is the president of the United States Bridge Federation. Thank you very much, Mr. Becker, for speaking with me, and good luck.
Thank you very much. Well, we hope to be walking in the stadium someday carrying a flag.
From time to time, colleges and universities might choose to cancel a varsity sport. Sometimes it's because that particular sport isn't attracting participants or because another sport is being added to the varsity roster. But how often does a school eliminate varsity sports entirely? Only a Game's Karen Given visited one school doing just that and has this report.
On a recent Wednesday afternoon in a Burlington, Vermont auditorium, Champlain College head basketball coach Bob Tipson leads his players through drills. As they prepare to enter the second half of their season, these players are under plenty of pressure. This is, after all, the last season for varsity basketball at Champlain College.
Ready? One. Let's go!
Tipson has coached basketball at Champlain for 33 years. He played here as a student in the 60s and led the school to their first appearance in the regional finals. His coaching record is impressive.
I think we've had one losing season in the 33 years that I've been here. We're very close to winning 700 games. You know, we've been to 5 national championships. We've finished 3rd in the country once. We've, in the neighborhood of 20-plus seasons, we've been in district or regional playoffs. So, you know, it's a pretty successful program.
Despite Tipson's winning record, in the summer of 2000, the university decided to cancel the program and the 2 other varsity sports at the school in favor of an intramural sports and fitness program open to all students. Freshman basketball player Drew Skeeter says he doesn't understand that decision.
Everywhere you go in the newspapers, we got the Champlain Beavers farewell season. You know, we always get asked questions in the classroom. You know, people on the street, they always ask you, like, man, how do y'all feel about that? And we really can't really do much about it.
It took almost 10 years of study for the trustees of Champlain College to decide to cancel varsity sports. In 1991, the school began offering four-year college degrees, but kept their junior college athletic affiliation until they could join a conference of four-year schools. But before long, discussions with students and colleagues at other universities led the school to another option. What if Champlain were to cancel all varsity sports and invest the money saved in athletic programs for the whole student body? The school could afford intramural leagues, wellness classes, and adventure trips for everyone. Although many in the community knew Champlain was studying the radical idea, no one really thought the college would go through with it, according to Burlington Free Press assistant sports editor Patrick Garrity.
Everyone was a little bit surprised because they didn't believe that it was an either-or proposition. You're talking about a school that pays the city to borrow a neighborhood auditorium and has their soccer athletes walk down the road a mile to use the city park, so it's not exactly the Ritz.
Champlain College admits three varsity sports weren't taxing the budget, but of the school's 2,500 students, only 50 were varsity athletes. Very few of the 2,450 remaining attended varsity games, but many of them did enjoy playing sports themselves, going to the gym, or joining extracurricular clubs. Kay Kennedy, Vice President for Student Services, says the decision wasn't really about what the school could do. It was about what it should do.
It was a philosophical decision, and you know, a lot of folks have asked, was it a financial decision? And it wasn't financial in the sense that we're a struggling institution. But I think if we're going to improve our facilities, if we're going to enhance our faculty, if we're going to enhance our academic programs, we have to be careful about how we allocate our resources. And we felt that by allocating the amount of resources that we were for activities and programming that would appeal to the broadest number of students, that it was really a very wise fiscal decision as well as a strong philosophical statement about what the college values.
Just a block from campus at the Burlington YMCA, more than a dozen Champlain students gather for an intramural volleyball game. Recreation coordinator Jenna Knott says it isn't a bad turnout for the small school, especially considering all the other options students had this week.
We had intramural basketball on Monday. We have intramural hockey on Tuesday and Wednesday. Last night we took a ski trip to a local area that has night skiing. We have volleyball tonight, which is Wednesday. Tomorrow night we have intramural soccer. Friday there's a floor hockey league. Saturday we're going ice climbing. Sunday we're going to another ski area. In weeks to come we have snowshoeing trips, mountaineering, indoor rock climbing. We also had kickboxing, body sculpting, and yoga going on this week.
Across town, turnout is even better for a midnight intramural ice hockey game. Hockey was one of the first sports added after the university decided to give more support to intramurals, and so far, it's been successful. Ashley LeBlanc is a sophomore at Champlain and one of the regular ice hockey players. She says most of Champlain's students aren't worried about losing varsity sports. If you were to choose a college based on its varsity sports program, she says, you wouldn't choose Champlain.
That's very true. I didn't go to one basketball game. I don't even know where they play. I don't know anything about them. So, yeah, definitely. I think the basketball players are pretty upset, but that's probably just about it.
Accounting professor Dave Mona and head resident Brent Navari volunteered to co-coordinate the league, in part so they'd have a place to play hockey. Mona says the school has made good on its promise to support intramurals.
The school has not balked at any of my requests. They've given me a very long leash because Brent and myself really just, I wouldn't say we didn't know what we were doing, but certainly we'd never done anything like this before, and it was very much an experiment. And I think the biggest testimony is people come back every week. Everybody from last year who came back to school came back out to skate with us.
At least once during the game, the referee has to stop and ask the players the score. It's competitive hockey, but not always serious. But this little league of four teams has something the varsity basketball and soccer teams lacked. They have fans.
I hate to compare it to varsity sports because, you know, I'd love to see both the intramurals and the varsity going. We have, you can see, there's a few students in the stands. We had one game this year. We had about 50 people in the stands cheering. Unfortunately, most of them cheering against the white team.
Since Champlain decided to cancel varsity sports, the budget for intramural and club activities has more than doubled. The school hopes to soon break ground on a new multi-million dollar fitness facility. Overall, Kay Kennedy says Champlain's commitment to sports is going up, not down.
I think for us, we're not giving up sports. We're just refocusing our attention on club and intramural sports and not on a varsity program that may appeal to a relatively limited number of students in favor of a program that might appeal to larger numbers of students and a broader cross-section of our students.
It's obvious that many Champlain College students are enjoying their new intramural programs. Whether or not they will miss their varsity teams will be seen in the next few years. If that's the case, Kay Kennedy says with a smile, we can always bring them back. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Burlington, Vermont.
To see pictures of Champlain College's last basketball team, as well as the intramural sports already underway, visit our website, www.onlyagame.org. Also, check out the winner and runners-up in our Super Bowl Haiku Challenge.